episode 5 of our series, Look What Dragged the Cat In, by Scott Stevens. If you have listened to the earlier programs, you know what this is about. If you haven't, let me fill you in. Scott is a journalist, and he posts regularly on health and alcohol issues for online news services, and is a founding influencer at the world's largest medical portal, HealthTap. He blends intensive evidence-based research with his wit and journalistic objectivity, and he has this book, I think it's his fifth book, but if I made a mistake, he'll tell me, and it talks about the rise of the opioid crisis and how alcohol is the gateway drug to this problem. And in this relationship, we've decided to use Ben Franklin's T-chart analysis of the problem, and the problem is the question, should I drink alcohol? You go all the way back to the first in the series, and it explains it, and we're going to have you fill out a T-chart like Benjamin Franklin did, putting all the bad things that you hear on the left side and all the good things that you hear on the right side. And then when you're done, you make the decision. Do you want to drink alcohol or do you not? If you're not already addicted to the drug, then I think that it's a no-brainer. I don't see how any rational human being could say, yes, I want to drink alcohol, when you have all the facts. If you are already addicted to the drug, I invite you to get my book, Freedom from Addiction 3, from Amazon, and it tells you how to escape any of the 30 addictive compulsive behaviors. So let's get into it. We'll get back to where we left off. Scott, it's nice to have you back for the fifth show.
Thanks again, Wynn. I appreciate the opportunity. And yeah, it's like we're neighbors a couple of states away almost, because we've been chatting so much about this topic. But as I told you before, I love the idea, and the more we talk, the more we change the dialogue out there.
Well, when we do our next program, the sixth program, you will have the longest running series on my radio internet talk show, and I don't know how long it'll take us to get through it all, because you've done such good, extensive work on what alcohol does to a body, and we need to get these facts out to the public, because alcohol is a terrible disease, but it's only one of the addictive diseases, and it's one that we're going to hone in on so that we can help everybody that hears the program try to have a better life. So where I have that we left off was we had said that alcohol interacts adversely with more than 120 over-the-counter and prescription medications. And the next point is it reduces the effectiveness of many medications or renders them useless. Can you make a comment?
Yeah, if you look at how, let's take antidepressants, for example. Alcohol first doesn't interact well with those. It's not going to be a fatal interaction. It's usually a nausea. But the worst part of the interaction with antidepressants is you're taking a depressant. So it's just going to wipe out any effect that you're getting. And, you know, there's a chicken and egg relationship between alcohol and depression anyway. There's some degree of depression that is caused by addiction, certainly, but also just by taking a central nervous system depressant. But on the other hand, you know, there's systemic depression, stuff you may have been born with, or you're dealing with trauma, and as a result and result of that trauma, you have experienced either a major depressive disorder or even just a run-of-the-mill depressive disorder. If there is such a thing, and somebody who's suffering for depression will tell you nothing's run-of-the-mill about this. But if you already have a depression, it can make it worse, and alcohol can cause depression. So the effectiveness of any antidepressant is going to be negated if it doesn't already have a physical side effect or physical interaction with the depressant or the prescription. Zoloft, I'm talking about citalopram, number of brand names on the market today. You're probably more aware of some of those than I would be, but
back when I was practicing, they all wanted Prozac.
Right, and still alive and well from what I hear.
So, to make a comment about depression from my point of view, from the addiction point of view, depression is one of the 20 symptoms of the broad disease of addiction. So, if you have depression, it's not because you're low on an antidepressant. It's because you have a different problem, in this case a spiritual problem, that can be corrected, and alcohol just makes it worse. Talk to us about the effectiveness with sleep medications or heart medications with alcohol.
You know, for centuries, people have treated sleep problems with alcohol, because it is a central nervous system depressant. And by some measure, it is somewhat effective as a sleep aid, because it can bring down your breathing. It's a central nervous system depressant. It's going to help you get to sleep. But that's the end of the any sort of positive, because it ultimately sacks your ability to get good sleep. And I think we covered this in one of the other episodes, but when you mix this with a sleep medication, when you mix these two drugs together, you can go anywhere from Roseanne Barr on this, where your behavior becomes very unusual, or to a more significant physical side effect. You're putting a depressant on top of a depressant, so it can cause impaired breathing, and it can sedate you to the point where not only your motor control is gone, but your non-motor, autonomic systems, that's it, begin to shut down. So it can be fatal, but most importantly, anytime you think of taking a sleep medication, there's plenty of other alternatives. Change your sleep hygiene, for one. That's one thing that I work with a lot of people on in the early parts of recovery is, if you've been drinking to sedate yourself, if your excuse for drinking is, then it helps me sleep, well, let's find a different way, a more sane, a more practical way than putting one drug in your body that sedates you, and then following up with alcohol. With heart medications, it's a different type of relationship. First of all, back to the episode that we did talk about the heart. Alcohol is not good for the heart. First of all, it increases blood pressure. Second of all, it increases triglycerides in your blood system, is a leading pathway to heart disease. But overall, it weakens the heart muscle. And, some people are on heart medications because of their relationship with alcohol. Number one killer of alcoholics isn't cirrhosis, it's heart disease. So people with the disease of alcoholism, or people who've had a long relationship with alcohol, have already done some heart damage. That may be, in fact, why they're on those heart medications. But when you mix alcohol with that, you have the potential for sudden changes in your blood pressure, and that is, first of all, a very dangerous thing to have. Sudden changes in your heart pressure, that increases your risk for, blood pressure, so that's going to increase your risk for stroke. But it can also cause a rapid heartbeat or an arrhythmia, a regular heartbeat. So these drugs are meant to be taken without a sedative, without a central nervous system depressant to help regulate the heart. And when you're on heart medications, it's the interaction can be fatal.
Absolutely. Now, the next point is that you said a common cause of severe liver damage requiring a transplant is a combination of using acetaminophen or Tylenol with alcohol.
Bad mix. Well, as we've kind of got to the direction we're going here, mixing it with any medication is not going to do you favors. But especially in the case of acetaminophen, Tylenol, other NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, these drugs, when even if you're not drinking alcohol, you really got to take some caution with them because they can wreak havoc on your liver anyway, but they can also do some, tear up your stomach, something fierce. And by the way, I do take a regular dose of ibuprofen just because I'm 52 and I got aches and pains. You know, I'm as guilty as the next fella. But when you're taking alcohol with these drugs, remember, alcohol is a drying agent. It takes water out of your system. That's why the men's room is always very busy at baseball games and at any tavern, because you're not only inputting the fluid into your body, but you're inputting a drying agent into the body as well. So with less water in your body, you have less to dilute this medication, and especially in the case of putting it in your stomach, where every single bottle of anti-inflammatory or any kind of pain reliever is always going to say take with 12 ounces, 16 ounces of water to help dilute that. Well, if you're ripping the water out of your body at a pretty ferocious rate under alcohol, you're diluting that alcohol, you're diluting that pain med, and you're also diluting you're getting rid of what is diluting that drug inside your stomach, so the damage to the stomach lining is nearly as bad as the damage to the liver. But remember, the liver is this mighty organ inside the body, amazing power to replenish itself, but the more you damage it with any kind of toxin, and at certain levels, acetaminophen and other pain relievers are toxic as well. This alcohol happens to be toxic from the word go. So the more toxins you dump into that liver, the more damage you're doing, and the more irreversible damage you can create.
A lot of people take supplements, herbal supplements, and there is an associated interaction with alcohol, with these herbal remedies, such as St. John's wort, chamomile, valerian, lavender, and also, this isn't an herb, but also with antihistamines. So there's millions of people taking these other things that drinking alcohol too does not mm-hmm. any good.
Yeah, antihistamines, different category, but boy, that can cause you to pass out, lose consciousness. I mean, that's a big deal. But here, we look at all these other herbal remedies that are known to, first of all, be a sleep aid, something like kava or melatonin, St. John's wort you already mentioned, even down to catnip. But the interactions, first of all, don't drive, because if you're taking any of these, God, I just thought of another one, Jamaican dogwood. I mean, I've looked at all of these. Valerian is interesting because, God, that stuff smells like hell. But if you wanted to take it, it does help put you to sleep. But you're again, this is the sedative argument that or the sedative discussion that you and I have had regarding central nervous system depressant, aka a sedative, on top of another sedative. You're double sedating yourself here. So you can pass out, lose consciousness. Definitely don't want to be operating heavy machinery at that point. But look at the other dangers to that. I mean, just walking around your house, if your motor skills are impaired and sedated, then you know, you increase your likelihood for trips, falls, slips, those things around the house that that can land you in the hospital or worse, but certainly cause inconvenience for you and for the loved ones that, with whom you live.
A lot of the time when I tell people that my mission in life is to help people get over their addictive problems, they say, oh, you treat alcohol, tobacco, and drugs. Well, that's kind of funny in a way, because alcohol is a drug. And the caveat here is, don't mix drugs. Whatever they are. Because you're not going to get any benefit out of mixing drugs, and it may kill you.
Yeah, and you know, one thing I didn't write about, because I'm still doing more research on it, is diet pills, weight loss medications, whether it's you know, this hydroxycut stuff that is ragingly popular, or any of these others. They are amphetamine derivatives, so they appear to work on the central nervous system as well, speeding it up. And, you know, this is a depressant, so you're speeding it up and slowing it down. That's going to have repercussions for your heart, certainly, and cause dizziness. But, you know, there's also, back to our depression discussion, you're ripping your body up and down physically by having a stimulant and a depressant in the system. It's hard, and it creates an imbalance with the dopamine and serotonin in the brain. And that's where my research is starting to reveal right now on weight loss pills, because they are so popular. And, you know, some of them say this is a natural way to lose weight, or this is, you know, since they took ephedra off the market, there's a number of different ways that people are trying to doctor their bodies. And we're not talking about things like the South Beach diet. I'm talking about the pills that you buy at your Walgreens or CVS. And it appears, at least at this stage in my research, that the interaction is as bad as with sleeping pills. It's just a different kind of bad.
Yeah. As you mentioned, weight loss is something that everybody is wanting to do. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry in all sorts of different modes and mechanisms. But remember this, overeating is one of the 30 addictive behaviors, and is probably easily in the top 5 in the country. So you're approaching it from the wrong way when you want to take a pill, and you're approaching it the wrong way when you want to overexercise. But you can get over it, but you have to know what the basis for addiction is and treat that specifically, as I have said before. Now, the next thing that I read from you, and this would make a great quote, and I think I'll put it up on Twitter, alcohol doesn't care how smart you are.
And isn't that the truth?
And you said this is especially true when it's mixed with opioids. It will take down the smartest person, or the least smart person. It's no respecter of your smartness. So if you think that you're too smart to get trapped with these drugs, you're wrong.
And, you know, this is the thing that is really at the cornerstone of look what dragged the cat in. We self-prescribe an awful lot because we know better, or those side effects that Scott was just talking about, those are for other people. They're not for me. I'm smarter than that. You know, it doesn't take much. It just takes one time, and the interaction can be fatal. It can be life-threatening, and it can be have lasting consequences throughout, because you were smarter than the pharmacist, or you thought that I'm talking about somebody else. And I can say this just rolling my eyes, because I thought I was smarter than this drug as well. It's part of the nature of taking a mind-altering drug. You're convincing yourself that it doesn't have the impact, the effects, the consequences that it truly does. And like I said, these can be life-threatening, every one of them. Simply by consuming the drug, you're taking a toxin and known carcinogen. So you're increasing your risk for cancer. And you can easily say, you can easily convince yourself, well, I don't drink that much where it's going to make that kind of difference. But science says otherwise. Science says that this is a carcinogen in any amount. So whether you think you've dodged the risk factor by being a moderate drinker or having just one drink a week, any amount, I think it was maybe episode 1 or 2 where we were talking about the relationship of cancer. Oncologists in the studies, in the evidence-based studies, say, don't fool yourself. No amount is safe when it comes to the risk of cancer. You're increasing your risk. So all these other things aside, whether I believed I was smarter than the drug, or I convinced myself that all these consequences weren't true, they're proven.
When we talk about thinking that you're smarter than the drug, and how, you know, other people say things that, even if they were true, doesn't apply to you, I wonder if you remember looking at advertisements on television for legal pharmaceutical grade drugs, and say, if you take this drug, this, that, or the other can happen. And on quite a few of them, the last thing that they say is death. Now, I'm wondering, how much risk are you willing to bet your life on? 1 in 1,000? 1 in 10,000? Are you willing to say, well, you know, I mean, it's not a very big risk, and I'm willing to take it. Are you willing to do that with alcohol? So that's what I think about that.
Yeah. The risks definitely, and you look at this T-chart, they're adding up into definitely not being worth it. Because so far, the gains we have, they're non-existent. Or they're things that we put in the 7 inches between our left ear and our right ear, with the things that we think alcohol does to us rather than what it actually does to us. What alcohol does for you is not equivalent to what it does to you.
Here's a fact that I got out of your book. Over 2,000 people die every year from drinking too much too fast with an alcohol overdose. You hear about this all the time, and college kids and other people that go to parties or whatever, and they binge. And when you're binging, you don't know which drink is going to be the one that produces your death. So,
yeah, well, it's not the caboose that hits you anyway. You know, you started with the first drink. So that's the risk of overdose. I mean, you have to consume a lot in a short amount of time. Or you have to have an impairment in your system, whether it's a digestive impairment, a problem with your liver. I mean, the toxicity of this is pretty strong. But the number of overdoses from alcohol, yeah, it's a lot lower than what the overdose numbers show for opioids. But still, it's a risk, nonetheless, and you're exactly right. You don't know which one of those killed you, which one of those drinks killed you.
Well, when you're talking about opioid overdose, and that's a critical issue in society today, and it hits home more than you know. Last week, I had a renter whose father called me and said that my renter had died a couple days previously from a narcotic overdose. And, you know, it could be your renter, it could be your brother, your son, your daughter, your grandchild, or whatever. But it is hitting all over the country and destroying family relationships at a terrible rate. And I think that that's something that we really need to think about when we decide to use opioids. Even if the doctor had given us a prescription for a reasonable supply for a painful condition, you have to decide whether or not it's worth the risk of possibly becoming addicted to them, because that happens every day too.
It does, and you're an expert on addiction, and you've identified, you know, the pathways to addiction. The pathway is a shorter one, for certain, with opioids. The research behind Look What Dragged the Cat In also took a look at people who are taking things as prescribed rather than self-medicating. Back a little bit to our conversation earlier in the hour, where they're self-prescribing. Well, you know, the doctor said take one every 8 hours, and it's been six, and I'm in a raging amount of pain, so I'm just going to go ahead and prescribe them. Well, then you've increased your risk of addiction on a very addictive drug by putting more into your system than was prescribed. The prescriber regs are very clear on the amount that you should be taking and at the intervals at which it should be taken. The number of overdose deaths from people who have taken the drug as prescribed are very, very low. In the case of surgical patients, it's around 1%, or excuse me, it's less than 1%, and it's around 1% for oral surgery and dental procedures. So, you know, the number of people, their percentage is so low. It's still a risk, but at the end of the day, who's self-prescribing? Those who are putting themselves at even a greater risk of addiction from a very highly addictive substance in opioids. Same goes for alcohol. I mean, the more you self-prescribe yourself, the more you place yourself at risk for addiction. But in the case of opioids, you know, you're really playing with fire here, because the illegal street supply laced with fentanyl has the potential to be lethal in dose one, because you don't know how much you're getting on the streets.
Yeah. So we talked about alcohol doesn't care how smart you are. Opioids don't care how smart you are. But it could be truly said that either one of those two drugs make you stupid.
Oh, yeah.
And if you have any experience with either one of those drugs, you know that when you take them, you do stupid things. You do risky things. And when you take both of those drugs together at the same time, it increases your stupidity. So when you're at a party and you've been drinking and somebody offers you an opioid, and you say, well, okay, that's stupid, because like you said, you don't know what you're saying okay to. It could be a drug dose that's going to kill you then and there, and if that doesn't make you sit up and think, I don't know what I can say that would, but most people want to live. There's some that don't, but and for those people that don't, this might not be an argument for them, but for everybody that's listening today, if you want to live, alcohol and opioids make you stupid, make you do things that you wouldn't have done under other circumstances, and by the time that you've done them, they might do you in.
The nature of these all these mind-altering drugs is they alter the mind, and it works from the outside of the brain inward, which is your motor skills are out there on the periphery of your brain. Your judgment, there we go. That's exactly the crux of this. Your judgment is impaired very early on in the drinking cycle. So as the drinking session goes on, or your blood alcohol concentration goes up, your judgment hits the floor. You will do stupid things that an ordinarily smart person wouldn't do or wouldn't conceive of doing without that altering of the mind. And then, you know, when it comes to the more critical functions of the body, those are deeper in the brain. We get into the topic of alcohol overdose when your brain is so saturated with this drug that your heartbeat and body temperature begin to collapse in on themselves. But just from the outset of taking a mind-altering drug at the first dose, you're beginning to impair your judgment, and all bets are off, because you will agree to do things that I love to joke about this every time I go to the church auction, is that's why they serve beer there, so the prices go up. And guess what? It's true, because you're going to say, well, you know, this is a dinner for two at a local restaurant. Maybe it's even a hard one to get into, but you wouldn't think of paying $150 for a $50 dinner. You can say, well, I'm doing it for a good cause and all those other things, but also the alcohol comes into play and say, yeah, you know what, I think I'll bid $200 on that. And, you know, you begin to slur, and your thinking's already toast by then, so you're going to make those bids, and that is, that's just part of how this drug works on the brain.
Another example, Scott, is why do casinos give you free liquor?
Yeah, exactly. I was just out in Las Vegas over the Easter holiday, and I was witnessing that 24/7, just about. Not from me being up that late, but by the same people sitting at the same machines the next morning when I woke up and went down to get breakfast. There was a crazy amount of alcohol that flows in a gambling situation, and probably in the result of all your research, you've probably seen a connection between those two addictions, a substance addiction and a process addiction, hand in hand with each other.
Absolutely. I just want to make a comment that is a true statement. We were talking about alcohol causing an impairment in judgment. If you are in a bar and somebody buys you a drink, what do you think their motivation, generally speaking, is? You know?
Yeah, well, in a male-female situation, I can surmise here that it's, okay, one's going to try to bet the other, okay? But at the core of it, nobody does that with the intention of trying to kill the other person, okay? But that's what they're contributing to, ounce by ounce. You know, you're giving them, hey, can I interest you in a glass of toxin and carcinogen? No. It's friendship, or you know, trying to get that person to your side of the ledger, and whether you excuse it as conviviality or friendship, you know, I wouldn't ask my friends to drink nail polish remover either.
Right. Okay. Let's see. I wrote down that you said that most people in the United States have both liver disease and associated kidney dysfunction. Most of the people that have both of those things are alcoholics. One of the kidney's job is to keep the right amount of water in your body. Alcohol causes you to dehydrate by increasing your urine output. Of course, we mentioned that previously, but here's the deal. if you are alcoholic, you are going to probably have a significant kidney and or liver damage from being that.
Yeah, no question. Those two organs in particular, we look at the downstream damage that putting this into your system can do. Those are the first two of the first three. I mean, it's going to go through your stomach, into your bloodstream. Actually, go through the first part of your small intestine is the main place of absorption, which means it goes directly into your bloodstream, which means it's going straight to your brain, straight to your liver, straight to your kidneys. And the hormone fluctuations it causes, plus the fact that it is a drying agent, you know, all these things come into play and create disaster for certainly for the brain, but man, look what it does to that liver, and displacing the fat around the liver so it can get to the task of processing the alcohol that you dumped into it. And then with the kidneys, you know, thank God we got two, but you're going to damage both of them at the same rate.
Yes. So if you've been writing down all the negative things that Scott has told you about alcohol on your Benjamin Franklin T-chart, by now you have accumulated a very large amount of negative things. And we're not going to stop now, because we're going to continue to tell you so that you'll have all the information that you need. But even if you were to stop now, the normal, average, rational thinking person would not be able to say, yes, I want to drink. So, any rate, getting back to some of the things that I pulled from Scott's book, and this is really a great book, and it serves a really great purpose in the world of giving people the opportunity of learning what they're doing to themselves when they drink alcohol. You know, unless you're ready to kill yourself, it's stupid. You said daily or binge drinking, and I believe that you define binge drinking as drinking eight drinks for a woman or 15 drinks for a man. And at any rate, either one of those two things doubles your risk for kidney disease. And do you want to go to a dialysis center twice a week for the rest of your life, which won't be that long?
The notion of taking, I view the kidney as kind of like the general store, and what it does is it doles out the chemicals, the minerals, the electrolytes, magnesium, phosphorus, sodium, vitamins, vitamin B. You know, it disperses them into the body before excretion, before urinating. So you're taking that general store and saying, okay, the store's shut down because we got alcohol in our system. So the other parts of your body aren't getting the supplies they need from that general store. And the dialysis process, painful from what I understand, but even if it was pain-free, you still have the hassle and the commute and all the other associated difficulties with having to rely on a machine to do that general store function for your body versus your body working the way it was designed to work.
Yes, kind of a analogy is in the smoker and having to carry the machine, meaning oxygen, around with you 24 hours a day in order to live. Is it worth it to smoke to have that result later on in life?
It's certainly not attractive. And even if you take that part of the attraction out of the equation, how it looks to other people, the inconvenience of it all, was that worth that extra drink or that extra six-pack or even the first sip? You know, the idea of having to rely on something else, mechanical, are external because you've damaged the internal stuff you were given. It, granted, there are a good many people on this planet who are born with deficiencies in their bodily structure, whether it's abnormality, a disability, however you want to explain it. But you're creating that willingly? That's insane.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. That is insane. Sane people don't make decisions that they're going to do something that don't have any positive benefits and take the risk of dying or having a life-changing disability for the rest of their life. That is insane to do that.
You don't see that in the Budweiser commercials, do you?
No, they don't. They don't show people having the complications of drinking. So let's see. We had talked about stroke before, and we had said that alcohol is bad for your risk of stroke. Let's just hit this point and see if there's anything extra in here. Stroke is the leading cause of long-term disability in the United States. The leading cause of long-term disability. And increased stroke risk for drinkers of either sex or age increases with only moderate consumption. Now, what do you call moderate consumption? Where's the line between what you can drink and not have an increased risk of stroke?
In episode 2 or 3, it was episode 3, we talked about stroke. And at the very first drink, your risk doubles for a stroke and remains elevated for another 2 hours after that drink. So that is moderation defined. We say, well, drink responsibly, drink in moderation. Well, that first drink is automatically going to elevate your risk of stroke. So the minimum is right there in that first glass that you order from the bartender or pick up at the grocery store or liquor store. You know, the other risk factors for stroke, hypertension, and what does alcohol do? Alcohol increases your blood pressure. And obesity, well, alcohol and weight loss don't go hand in hand unless all you're doing is drinking and you're basically at the end of the scale there when it comes to your weight. You're going to be malnourished. But even with a regular diet, alcohol causes obesity because your liver isn't working on the fat that you're putting into it. It's setting it aside into your other tissues, mostly surrounding the liver. So you're going to have a problem with your weight being on the higher end of the scale. So there's two other ways that drinking is going to increase your risk. But really, that looking at the Canadian study that did that, you know, your risk is 1.6 to 2 points higher right at the first drink. That should be enough.
Some people say, with talking about addictive behaviors, everything's okay if you only do it in moderation. But with respect to alcohol, from what you've told us, moderation doesn't come into the equation because you can't drink moderately and not be at risk.
Exactly. And that is an issue that I have taken the alcohol industry to task on, is that you're saying that there is such a thing as drinking responsibly by drinking in moderation, but that's not drinking responsibly if it's increasing your risk of heart disease, stroke, death. These things are not responsible things to subject yourself to. So if you're looking at an alcohol ad, what it says, drink responsibly, drink in moderation, or even don't drink and drive, you know, that raises the issue. Well, it's okay to just drink then, right? Because it's legal in this country. Well, you know what? Legal and everything, yeah, that's all fine and well, and I intend to continue to stay on the side against prohibition, but we got to be more factual about the way we're presenting this drug, in that there is no safe amount, there is no moderate amount when it comes to heart health, when it comes to cancer risk, certainly when it comes to the risk for the unborn. But where does responsible come into to factor in this with all the advertising that they're is their main nail that they're hanging their coat on right now?
Mm-hmm. Well, prohibition, whether it be for alcohol or narcotics or whatever, indicates that the truth of the matter is that government can regulate morality and regulate you making the correct decision. Government can't do that. It's proven that they can't do that, and so every time that they do that, they fail. And so we have to take personal responsibility for everything that we put in our mouth. You know, whether the government says you can't have it, or whether the government says it's legal, you can have it. It comes down to your own morality, your own personal responsibility, your own integrity, and that's where the burden lies with the individual. Okay, a couple more things about stroke. This was interesting. I read that stroke risk is increased among men who have had at least one hangover per year. Now think about it. Have you ever had a hangover? Well, if you have, that year your stroke risk went up. And, you know, until you wrote that, I didn't have any idea that stroke relationship was that critical. That
was an interesting study, and what I liked about that way of making that conclusion is it puts it into common experience. You know, if it said, well, if you had a lot of studies based on the quantity you drink in one sitting, and the quantity that you you drink in a week, or how many times a week, you know, all these other breakdowns. But that was one that just said, hey, if you've had one hangover, you've increased your risk of stroke just because of the disaster that creates inside of your body in that one drinking event, so bad that you felt it the next day, and you don't forget about those things. You might forget about how many drinks you had last week or how many drinks you tell yourself you had in your last outing with the buddies, or bottle of wine you had with dinner. How many of those glasses did I have? How many did the missus have? You know, you those things you kind of slide past, or might not remember the exact amount, but boy, you sure remember your hangovers.
I was thinking, if you are a person that goes to bars, whether it be a wine bar or a regular bar or whatever, and you have a stroke, and it's one of the bigger things that are associated with strokes in young people, because young people don't have strokes, but young people drink a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't make it out of the bar because you can't walk, because your legs don't work anymore. How are you going to feel about that? Was it worth it to have that drink? Did you get enough out of it to not be able to use your extremities and perhaps never even to be able to rehab? Think about that, you know. Think about that when you're not drinking, when you're not stupid. Think about it when you're smart. And there's only one conclusion that one can make from that. A smart person doesn't drink alcohol. Well, so much for being on my soapbox.
make room for me. I get up there quite frequently, but having the facts to back up what you and I talk about, that does help the dialogue. I mean, yes, I have done incredibly stupid things by putting this toxin and carcinogen in my body. That was a very uninformed decision at first, and second of all, it was as a result of being chemically dependent after so many years of doing that. But when I look at how you and I and the rest of us can change this tide, is look at, you know, where does this begin to be fun? Where, you know, you may be laughing and giggling, but if you look at the research that says this is what you're doing to the body, it's a life of which you only have one, and even doing it in moderation, you know, then that first drink becomes less and less likely. And no alcoholic ever became alcoholic without taking that first drink. No person, none of these statistics and none of this data supports an increased risk for a person who doesn't take alcohol. And there have been a number of studies that say, well, abstinence isn't good for you either. Look who's funding them. Back to our discussion in episode one, follow the money. Because in a lot of these studies, there's alcohol money involved. And those studies where alcohol money is involved, the outcome for alcohol surprise is that it's beneficial to you in some way, some fashion or another. And really, when we're having the stroke discussion that we were having earlier, you know, there were studies that were funded by the alcohol that said it was protective against stroke incidents. And that's not the case when you look at the body of evidence, increasing obesity, increasing hypertension, atherosclerosis, all these other factors that it increases, say that no, it's not protective against that. Not in the least. But if you follow the money and you say, well, there's case in point. The alcohol industry paid good money to get the outcome that they wanted.
Thinking about advertisements and what they're trying to do to push their product and everything, I saw one for the casino here, and they had a bunch of people sitting around laughing and clapping their hands and seeming to have a great deal of fun when they won a bet. I wonder how much fun they have when they bet to the extent that they lose their home.
Yeah.
You know?
There are things that we gamble with in the process of drinking that a sane, sober person would not gamble. And that is your life, your home, your job, your family. These are wagers we don't take when there's not this mind-altering substance involved.
Yeah, it makes you stupid.
Okay. Thanks, Wynn. I resemble that remark.
Okay. You said a depressed person who abuses alcohol is at a much higher risk of attempting or succeeding at suicide, and you gave a figure of 7% of alcoholics will commit suicide. I didn't know that, but here is proof, rock hard, that your risk of killing yourself and ending your life is greater if you're depressed and or drink and you're depressed. So that should be a wake-up call for some people, I think.
Yeah. All these things can be fixed, whether it's the alcoholism, through your book, you know, looking at any other addictive behavior, these can all be fixed. Depression can be treated as well. All of these things are not, don't have to be fatal, but when you make that decision to take your life because of the depression, because of your addiction, that decision is irreversible. And people come to it more easily under the influence, you know, of the drugs, whether it's this drug or any other. When your mind is altered, that might have been the one synapse that kept you from taking your life, and you bathe it in a toxin and convince yourself that, yeah, this was the only way out. But you can't take that bet back.
I want to tell you a sideboard story. Back when I was practicing medicine, about 10% of the people that came in to see me came in with the symptom of depression. And the vast majority at that time were asking me for a prescription for an antidepressant. And I believe the most common one was Prozac. I said to these people routinely, you're not depressed because you're low on Prozac. The depression is coming from another cause. Now, take this prescription. And I said, go out every day and do something that helps another individual without trying to get anything back from that. Just do it because I said to do it because of your depression, and come back in 30 days and tell me what the story is. And you know, the vast majority of the people were not depressed and didn't want the Prozac after they found that helping other people gave them a way of relieving their symptoms that caused the depression in the first place. So I just throw that out to you that that many of the symptoms of the disease of addiction can be helped by having a life purpose. And most every life purpose has something to do with helping other people. So
this is, we talk about this quite a bit with the people in the audiences to whom I'm speaking, or with individuals one-on-one. The helper's high is a real high. It is a trackable, traceable response to doing something good, and good being a subjective term, but it's doing something like you're describing, helping another human being. And when you do that, when we get off the phone on a Friday after our talks, you know, there's an elevation in me that I know that our conversations are helping at least one person, and that is enough. That's enough of a high for me. And you know, if we can look at the many ways that we are seeking our highs, and this one is free and right in front of everybody, well, it skips a trip to the dope man for sure, or the liquor store, but it does the body good.
So I was thinking that this point is brought up in my book, Freedom from Addiction 3, but it's one of the most important things that you can discover in your life that will dramatically change it. And my belief and theory, which has been backed up by hundreds and thousands of people that I've talked to and everything, is no matter who you are, you're not here on this planet for no reason. There is a reason for your existence. And to find out what your purpose, your mission, your destiny is, however you want to characterize it, is the most important single thing that you can determine in your lifetime that will make a significant difference in your life. And we've been going at it from different points of view here in our various discussions and everything, but just think about it. Why are you here? Okay? So, let's see. Oh, here's an important one, and this will have to be the last point because we're getting ready to go over an hour. Alcohol consumption compromises your immune system. And your immune system is what keeps you healthy. It keeps you from having cancer. It keeps you from having rheumatoid arthritis and all sorts of other things. So, what is the correlation between not having a great immune system and drinking alcohol?
Well, one of the things that we look at with alcohol goes this discussion with immune system goes back to Dr. Benjamin Rush in the late 1800s, and you know, we've theorized that alcohol kills bad germs, and it does it in a laboratory setting. We sterilize medical instruments in it, for example. But when it's in your body, it doesn't kill off the bad germs. That's what your T cells do in your body, and this is what Dr. Benjamin Rush discovered more than 150 years ago already. Wow. But if a T cell doesn't have the ability to work to fight off flu influenza, for example, you know, then you're going to get the flu because the body wasn't able to produce enough T cells under the influence of alcohol, and that the functions of that T cell are limited or reduced, just like your ability to do anything is reduced from a physical standpoint or a motor skills standpoint. The same kind of thing, you could say, happens to your T cells. They become lazy. They don't do the job that they're intended to do because of the influence of alcohol on those, on that one job that a T cell has, that's to fight off infection. So your immune system it revolves around T cells and T cell response. And if you're delaying that response, reducing that response, and reducing the production of T cells, then you've got a problem with your immune system.
Well, have you got enough reasons on your Benjamin Franklin T-chart now to make the decision of not wanting to drink because it's obvious that that there's too much risk? Well, if not, come back next week and we'll give you more reasons until you come to the conclusion this is not a smart thing to do. And Scott, thank you so much for your input. You have more facts at your disposal about scientifically based research and things that most people don't know about, that I really appreciate the opportunity of being able to get these facts out to the world, because it's going to do a lot of good for a lot of people. And I'll see you next week.
Thanks.